And out front next, the president laying out his plans to reopen parts of the country despite warnings from top health officials. This on the deadliest day in the United States so far. Plus apocalyptic. That's how one doctor inside one of the busiest hospitals in New York City describes the scene now. We're going to talk to a doctor on the front lines. And Louisiana sees a jump of more than 500 coronavirus cases in just one day. That is the fastest growth rate in the world. We're going to speak to a top official on the ground. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the breaking news, the deadliest day for Americans since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. At least 248 new deaths reported today. And another grim milestone. The United States now has the second most cases of coronavirus in the world. Second only to China, where infections were first counted months earlier than in the U.S. As of tonight, 81,313 Americans are known to have been infected, much smaller than what the real number, of course, would be. Yet the president again today talking about getting the country back to work, despite warnings from health officials, even those on his own team, that it may be too soon.
Now, people want to go back to work. I'm hearing it loud and clear from everybody. I think it's going to happen pretty quickly. A lot of progress is made, but we got to go back to work. We may take sections of our country. We may take large sections of our country that aren't so seriously affected.
That is part of a plan the president sent to governors today with potential new distancing guidelines, which are based on geography, you know, where you live and how the risk is ascertained based upon that. The president wants to identify what he calls, quote, high risk, medium risk and low risk counties for different levels of social distancing. You can imagine what many of the difficulties in such a plan might be, perhaps including this one.
What prevents somebody from a high-risk county going to a low-risk county? Don't you risk creating a patchwork system, allowing more cases to slip through the cracks and the virus to spread in other areas of the country?
I think this is a very important concept, and it's why we've really worked on messaging to the American people about these 15 days to stop the spread. Because part of this will be the need to have highly responsible behavior between counties. And I think the American people can understand that, that they will understand where the virus is because we'll have the testing data and where it isn't, and make sure that they're taking appropriate precautions as they move in and out of spaces. I think this will be critical for our future as we work together to really understand where the virus is and where it isn't in real time.
So we're relying on responsible behavior and testing data, which we just simply currently do not have. It doesn't exist. The president also saying tonight that the Navy hospital ship Comfort is scheduled to arrive in New York Harbor on Monday. New York, of course, is the hardest hit state so far. Nearly half the cases in the U.S. are there. And there are major concerns about a potential shortage of hospital beds in the city. Nick Watt is out front in Los Angeles outside Cedars-Sinai Hospital. That is where officials say supplies are literally day to day. Nick, and that, should cause many, fear for anyone listening. And there are major concerns about supplies in many states right now.
Absolutely. Listen, right here in California, Erin, we have just over 3,000 cases, basically bracing, preparing for a New York-style onslaught, I suppose. Tomorrow morning, the Mercy, another hospital ship, will actually dock here in the port of Los Angeles. 1,000 beds. The plan is to take people out of LA hospitals who are being treated right now, put them on that ship, and clear space for the COVID-19 cases we expect to come. And as you mentioned, today, though, Erin, has been a day of nationwide grim milestones.
More than 1,000 now dead here in the US, and this evening we surpassed Italy, now second only to China in confirmed cases, according to Johns Hopkins University.
But I think it's a tribute to the testing. We're testing tremendous numbers of people.
Meanwhile, on the front line,
all the feet that you see, they all have COVID.
And 13 died at this one New York hospital in one day.
We had to get a refrigerated truck to store the bodies of patients who are dying.
An ER doctor sharing a rare look inside her hospital with the New York Times.
I don't have the support that I need, and even just the materials that I need physically to take care of my patients, and it's America.
CNN has reached out to Elmhurst Hospital for official comment on the statements of this doctor.
Leaders in various offices, from the president to the head of health and hospitals, saying things like, we're going to be fine, everything's fine. And from our perspective, everything is not fine.
New York's governor says there is enough protective equipment for now, but distribution might be stop and start.
You cannot get the curve down low enough so that you don't overwhelm the hospital capacity.
Down in Miami, starting Friday night, a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew. That city council debate looked like this.
For the record, the motion passed unanimously, 5-0.
The first confirmed case in the U.S. was January 21st, Washington State. About a month later, the president said this.
We're going down, not up. We're going very substantially down, not up.
Today, more than 80,000 cases in every single state, according to a CNN tally. Take Michigan.
Just over 2 weeks ago, we had zero. This crisis is ramping up exponentially.
Now, nearly 3,000 Detroit, a hotspot.
Part of what we're seeing in Detroit is that there's such a high number of individuals who have those underlying conditions. And so what you're seeing now is when you have really generations of concentrated poverty, when you have pandemics like this, it's going to hit those places harder.
Now, Erin, you just played a little clip of Dr. Birx during that White House press conference talking about some counties being hit hard, some not so much. She singled out Wayne County, home of Detroit, and Cook County, home of Chicago, as places where we are seeing a more rapid increase. And between those counties, you're looking at nearly 7 million people just right there. Erin.
Nick, thank you very much. And I want to go out front now to Dr. Sanjay Gupta and Dr. Richard Besser, who is the former acting director of the CDC. Thanks so much to both of you. So, Sanjay, the grim milestone today, deadliest day, as we know, there will be more that fit that description. But tonight, the U.S. is surpassing Italy and now only second to China in the number of coronavirus cases altogether. What does that tell you? Again, we know that this is detection and it's some function of spread and testing. Do we know which it is more a reflection of?
Well, I think there's no question that the spread continues in the United States. And when you look at these numbers, some of that obviously reflects more testing, but it also reflects a picture of what was happening in this country, you know, 10 to 14 days ago. The scenario, Erin, would be somebody is exposed, it takes some time for them to develop symptoms, and then they get tested. By the time all that happens, you know, 10 to 14 days may have passed. So that's what we're seeing right now. And over the last 10 to 14 days, obviously, there's continued to be spread. You know, it's interesting, Erin, when we hear about these more rural places or places where they think there's not that many cases. Nick Watt was just talking about Michigan. Michigan had 15 cases last week. So you can see how much growth there is in places. A lot of places out there are saying, look, we seem to be okay right now. We have very few cases. Look what's happening in these other states around the country. This virus is spreading, and more testing will reveal that.
And Dr. Besser, the president seemed to downplay, you know, this milestone of where the United States is here in terms of infections tonight. Here's what he just said moments ago at the press conference.
You don't know what the numbers are in China. China tells you numbers, and I'm speaking to President Xi tonight, I believe. We'll have a good conversation, I'm sure. But you just don't know. You know, what are the numbers? But I think it's a tribute to the testing.
So he's both raising a question about what the numbers really were in China. And obviously, they were significantly higher than what they said, just like they are everywhere, maybe in part because of their government and what they were willing to say, and in part because of testing. But in the U.S., he says it's a tribute to the testing. Would you agree that the increase we're seeing is a tribute to the testing?
Well, I would agree with Sanjay that it's a combination of spread and increased testing. One of the key factors in this response that there's not enough discussion around is the critical role that trust will play in whether or not we are able to reduce the impact on the public. And that trust comes from knowing that decisions are made based on public health science. And we need to be hearing from CDC, from the top public health scientists in the world, so that when we're hearing something, a decision made for a policy perspective, we know the background, we know the science that went into that to make that policy decision. Right now, we can't tell what is being done politically versus what is being done based on evidence.
And Sanjay, to that point, this whole, you know, the president did not talk about Easter today and full churches. Mm. Didn't mention the word Easter at all, but did talk about people wanting to get back to work and relaxing social distancing guidelines. I don't know what those would be. Is it, you know, I'm not trying to make light of it, but, you know, it's 6 feet some places and not in other places. And, you know, right. You're trusting people on an honor system when you go from county to county. You heard Dr. Birx say you got to trust people to be responsible. I mean, could that ever work?
I think it would be very hard. I mean, look, I just put yourself in somebody like that shoes to Dr. Besser's point. I mean, so you're living in a county where, you know, most of the places around you, you still are practicing the social distancing, but this county is now being put back to work. I mean, every door handle you touch, every elevator button you push, I mean, every time you see a stranger, if somebody comes in from out of town, I mean, you have to think about the country as a whole here. I think it's very hard to sort of say we're going to have this patchwork of return, and the people who live in those areas, I mean, I think it's going to be sort of very confusing for them. And again, Aaron, just quickly point out again, young people can and people without symptoms can still spread this virus, and young people can still get sick from this virus. So put young people back to work. It's not like this virus won't affect them.
And let me just say here, because as these numbers are dynamically changing, we now are the most coronavirus cases in the world in the United States. So we have now just passed that above China. Again, we all know their numbers aren't really what they reported, but this is the direction this is going in this country. And now the United States has the most reported cases. Dr. Besser, on this point about, Trump saying this letter to the governors talking about these plans that he has to hopefully relax social distancing guidelines, some places and not others. But even people in his own task force apparently didn't know about all of them didn't know about that letter before he sent it. And the other day, Dr. Anthony Fauci, right, the infectious disease specialist who's on that podium almost daily, he made it very clear that it sounded to me like he wouldn't be on board with anything like that because he said this.
What we don't have right now that we really do need is we need to know what's going on in those areas of the country where there isn't an obvious outbreak.
So, I mean, he's basically saying we don't know what we don't know. Just because there's no obvious outbreak doesn't mean there's no problem there. Reopen it. It means we may not know there is an outbreak there.
Yeah. You know, one of the underlying principles is correct, and that's that pandemics are local outbreaks occurring on different timelines. But until there's widespread testing available and we can understand the various timelines and we can understand the significance of transmission by children, by people who are asymptomatic, it's really premature to talk about lightening up and opening certain areas. In the future, that's clearly something that you'd want to do. But right now, we don't know how much of what we're seeing nationwide in terms of numbers, in terms of deaths, is simply that we're testing, we're seeing what's already out there versus continued spread.
All right. Thank you both very much. And don't miss Sanjay. He's going to be with our CNN Global Town Hall on coronavirus coming up in less than an hour at 8 p.m. Eastern. And out front next, the scene inside a New York hospital being called apocalyptic. We're going to speak to a doctor about what it is like for him inside a New York City hospital tonight. Plus, what is going on in Louisiana, the state with the fastest growth rate in the world on known infections? The lieutenant governor is my guest. And a record number of Americans filing jobless claims. Small business owners across this country are asking, what now?
People are not going to be able to support their families.
New tonight, Outfront has obtained a photo of a truck that can be used as a morgue. We saw this outside a hospital in Manhattan. It is not the only one. I'll show you a photo of another truck at one of the hardest hit hospitals in Queens. This photo was obtained by the New York Times. New York City is deploying these refrigerated trucks as emergency rooms are overwhelmed with coronavirus patients. The chief medical examiner's office says they have a total of 45 trucks that are stockpiled that can be deployed as needed. Out front now, Dr. James Gasparino. He is the director of critical care services at the Brooklyn Hospital Center. Dr. Gasparino, I know you just spent 30 hours, with patients in the hospital. The president of your hospital tells the New York Times you're in disaster mode at your hospital. What is the situation like?
I would say from the ICU perspective, probably 80% of the patients in the ICU are either patients under investigation at very high risk for having the coronavirus or those already confirmed to have it. So, you know, the ICU population is clearly being dominated by patients with who are likely to be infected. I would also say the demographics of the people coming into the hospital that are not like ICE in critical care per se are have all the characteristics of infection, but with milder disease. So it's the population of the hospital now is really transforming into patients who are infected.
Oh, and so you're saying even beyond the ICU. So I know you've been dealing with several issues here. First of all, the possibility of rationing ventilators, using one machine possibly for two people. Is that something you think can work? Does that increase the risk? Or, I mean, are you at a point where you don't have a choice?
Well, we're not quite there yet. And I think that right now we have enough ventilators for the number of patients that we're seeing. We're also acquiring new ventilators and additional ventilators. I think that would be kind of like three steps or three phases down the road where we would have to do that. And we're doing simulation exercises using, one ventilator for two patient scenarios so that we're, when that time comes, we'll be ready to do that. Right now, though, we're not quite at that phase, but we are preparing, like many hospitals are doing, for if it ever came to rationing and making those tough decisions, we have an ethics committee and a group of people following the latest evidence to guide us in if it comes to that.
And as I mentioned, the New York Times had mentioned your hospital as well as others. One of the other ones that they mentioned specifically was the Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, which the situation there is horrific. It's been entirely dedicated to coronavirus patients, which I know you're starting to see as well. But the quote there was that calls over a loudspeaker of Team 700, the code for when a patient is on the verge of death, come several times a shift. Some have died inside the emergency room while waiting for a bed. Some patients have been found dead in their rooms while doctors were busy helping others. Obviously, this is Elmhurst Hospital in Queens. Does this sound, are you seeing anything like this? Do you anticipate seeing anything like this?
Well, at our hospital, we, pre-COVID-19, we developed a pretty robust critical care program that already had a team in place to deal with emergencies outside the ICU, staff, critical care attendings, and other really advanced practitioners in the latest technology to kind of be deployed to any emergencies in the hospital. So now we are seeing more calls. Now those calls for emergencies in the hospital tend to be related to COVID-19 patients with the coronavirus, simply because those are the patients who are really starting to populate our medical surgical floors outside the ICUs. So, for many people, it goes from mild to moderate to severe disease pretty quickly. And so that's what you're seeing at Elmhurst. We're starting to see some of that here at the Brooklyn Hospital Center. However, we have a pretty effective team in place to handle those patients.
All right. Well, Dr. Gasparino, I appreciate your time. I know your patients do as well. As I said, thank you for taking time to talk to us, even after putting in that 30-hour shift. Thank you, sir. And next, coronavirus cases in Louisiana skyrocketing. More than 500 new cases recorded there in just one day. One official calls it the disaster that will define a generation. Plus, a 38-year-old father of two with coronavirus, the lengths he is going to keep his family from getting sick. He's out front. New tonight, the next hotspot. Growing concerns tonight about the state of Louisiana and its alarming spike of coronavirus cases. We first told you about this earlier this week, and at this hour, there are now more than 2,300 detected cases in the state. That is six times the number of a week ago. The situation dire, and a top New Orleans official had this grim warning today.
This is going to be the disaster that's going to define our generation.
Ed Lavandera is out front.
On a day where the nation's coronavirus death toll passed the bleak 1,000 milestone, the focus is shifting to Louisiana, a state that may have the fastest growth rate of infections in the country.
We're not doing as well as we should. Not when we know what is coming down the road in the not-too-distant future.
There is an urgent need for medical supplies as confirmed cases skyrocket, increasing by more than 500 in less than 24 hours. The governor says that time is running out. Ventilators and protective equipment are in short supply, and hospitals in New Orleans alone could lack the capacity to provide proper care by next week without outside assistance.
We need resources from the federal government to unlock the change and really tear them down in the state of Louisiana so that we can meet our people where they are and so that we can give them the services that they desperately need, and particularly our health care professionals on the ground working tirelessly.
Dr. Rebecca G., CEO of LSU's Healthcare Services Division, says some health officials have resorted to buying hospital gowns on eBay. Other extreme measures are underway just to get the basic medical supplies they desperately need.
Making masks from Office Depot, plastic covers that you put on documents that you're trying to make look formal, and putting string and punching holes in them.
Health experts are monitoring six clusters at nursing homes, including Lambeth House Retirement Community in New Orleans, where as of Tuesday, officials say 11 people have died of COVID-19. A growing theory for the rapid spread is last month's Mardi Gras celebration in New Orleans, taking place weeks before the governor issued a stay-at-home order. The first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the state was from an individual who tested positive in the New Orleans area 13 days after the end of the iconic party, which draws thousands from all over the world. Officials say they believe the patient contracted the virus locally.
We had over 1.5 million people in the city, including international visitors, all attending parades daily.
Federal help is on the way. President Trump approved Louisiana's disaster declaration on Tuesday, and some residents are heeding the stay-at-home guidance, with movement in New Orleans down 73%, according to one federal official.
I have spoken to the political officials in New Orleans and in the state of Louisiana. They're now shutting things down in a very vigorous way. It is likely that that should have been done a little bit sooner.
And Governor John Bel Edwards warns that Louisiana's current trajectory is not sustainable, and compliance is crucial for the state's well-being.
Our future from where we are today, with the curve that we are on, is not promising.
And Aaron, this is Bourbon Street, and the French Quarter has not looked this quiet since Hurricane Katrina. This is a city and a region that is well accustomed to staring down the eyes of hurricanes, but being caught in the eye of a storm like a viral pandemic is not something this city is used to. Aaron?
All right. Thank you very much, Ed Lavandera. And I want to go out front now to the Republican Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, Bill Nungesser. And Lieutenant Governor, I appreciate your time. I mean, how would you describe what you're seeing right now on the ground?
Well, this is unprecedented. You know, we've taken over several of the state parks. We've moved all the tourists out of the state parks, sent them back home. Now we're going to be turning the convention center into a 300-bed hospital. This is serious. And, it hit America at a horrible time around Mardi Gras. And we love to hug people in Louisiana. So we're paying for it now. And we've got to take this serious. 28% increase in infection in just 24 hours. Over 80 people dead here in Louisiana. This is going to continue to get worse before it gets better.
So the governor has issued a stay-at-home order now, just a couple, 4 days ago. I want to play again, though, for you, Lieutenant Governor, what President Trump's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Fauci, said last night about your state. Here he is.
I have spoken to the political officials in New Orleans and in the state of Louisiana. They're now shutting things down in a very vigorous way. It is likely that that should have been done a little bit sooner. Not blaming anyone on that, but you get caught unaware.
So he says it's likely that should have been done sooner, not blaming anyone, but you get caught unaware. Your response?
You know, I take responsibility for that, too. I think, you know, we can always go back and say we should have, could have, would have. But, you know, tourism is a big business in Louisiana. $1.9 billion in taxes left here. by tourists last year. And, you know, you got to look out for the people that have these jobs in the restaurants and hotels and not wanting to make a call that you might not have regretted. So could we have done a little earlier? Maybe so. But I take as much responsibility as any elected official. But the thing now, we know what we've got, and we've got a shelter in place. We've got to do what the governor's asked and make sure we get control of this thing that has gotten a little out of control here.
And you were told, just to be clear, though, it's not like you were defying anyone with Mardi Gras, right? No one from the CDC or the NIH or anybody asked you to cancel it.
No, absolutely not. You know, and it hit right about that time, right after that. And even when we were asking people to support our local restaurants, didn't know how bad this could get this quickly. And I think the governor's taking the right steps in asking people to stay at home and not touch and keep our distance when you do go out to buy groceries. And and hopefully in the next week or so, we'll get hold of this.
Georgia's governor says he believes the coronavirus actually has been present in his state since December of last year. And that when history looks back there, you know, you're going to see that that was the case. Do you think that may be true for your state also and no one realized it? Or you really think that this was Mardi Gras?
No, I think it probably was here. I think Mardi Gras probably escalated it. And the reason we have so many cases here in Louisiana. But I think a lot of people that might have misdiagnosed it with the flu. So I think it was absolutely here, is my opinion, before Mardi Gras. And it just helped spread it.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Governor, I appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
We'll get through this. Thank you.
All right, sir. And next, more than 3 million workers, 3 million Americans just filed for unemployment. It is an all-time record.
I, you know, haven't slept. I'm worried about having a heart attack, to be perfectly honest with you.
And a patient with coronavirus reduced to communicating with his young children by notes pushed under the door. He's my guest next. Tonight, a record 3.3 million Americans filing for their first week of unemployment benefits last week. People across this country are losing their jobs in a stunning and unprecedented fashion thanks to coronavirus. And now many of them are struggling to figure out how to even put food on the table. Kyung Law is out front.
How you doing, guys?
It's just been a completely life-altering experience from start to finish, and within a week. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yep, I have a 2 ounce and I have an 8 ounce.
A record number of newly unemployed Americans as the virus leaves no business untouched.
We would have all of the seats filled.
All of these seats.
It would be a line out the door.
3.3 million filed jobless claims last week. Coronavirus cratering businesses.
We went from being about to franchise to basically running a to-go business. I, you know, haven't slept. I'm worried about having a heart attack, to be perfectly honest with you.
With no diners, the Drunken Crab is hemorrhaging thousands of dollars a day. Every business, every industry reevaluating under this economic tsunami.
Have a good night.
Josh Souter, already forced to make that hard choice.
I had to, you know, was forced to lay off 75 people. At first, you're thinking about them. Okay, I feel horrible for them. And then they have to go home and tell their family, I just got laid off.
I called my wife over the phone and said, honey, I'm on my way home. And she pretty much immediately knew.
There you go.
Laid off from the Drunken Crab, former general manager Jay Boken immediately filed for unemployment. And it's just the tip of the iceberg, say economists, predicting by summer, 14 million workers will lose their jobs due to the coronavirus shock.
You're talking thousands and thousands of people looking for work simultaneously. It's going to hit every aspect of life. And the government needs to react and help us get through this. That's the only way it's going to work. People are not going to be able to support their families for more than 2 months.
And already, signs money is getting tight. Outside this West Hollywood bar, employees only, a line. Inside, the small staff preps meals, free meals, for workers who show a pay stub.
Oh, wow.
like bartender Jerry Courtney Austin.
All of us, like, immediately lost our jobs, I think, as of Monday or Tuesday.
Are you worried about how long this is going to last?
100%. Yeah. If it goes on months, like, I don't think any of us have any idea what we're going to do.
The moment this happened, we're going to dig ourselves in a hole regardless.
Are you scared?
I'm concerned.
Restaurant owner Tom Sopit's rent is $1,000 per day. He doesn't want to fire anyone, but this is a new reality he will have to face.
Yeah. All we can do is help each other.
Now, Employees Only in West Hollywood has set up a GoFundMe page, hoping that the community will keep these free meals going. But there is only so long, given their overhead, given their payroll, that they can do this, because they are looking at an empty parking lot, just like this business is looking at an empty parking lot, just like American businesses across this country, Aaron, are looking at empty parking lots. Aaron?
Kyung, thank you very much. And next, a healthcare worker dying from coronavirus, the first medical professional in the United States known to succumb to the disease. Others on the front lines, though, are ill. How will hospitals manage? And a coronavirus patient whose illness has taken a toll on his entire family. He has very young children, one of whom suffers from a pre-existing condition. He's my guest next. New tonight, Americans on the front lines. They've been putting their lives at risk, and many are increasingly getting infected with coronavirus. More than 150 hospital workers testing positive at just a few hospitals in Boston. Out front now, Dr. Lakshman Swamy. He works at the ICU at Boston Medical Center. I know we talked to you a few days ago. I am glad you're back. I'm glad you're well. I know you're exhausted. And this is just one of the many things you have to deal with. Of those 150 infected workers in Boston, 15 are at your hospital, Boston Medical. Dr. Swamy, how worried are you?
I think every day we are, the atmosphere is so tense. So many of us have known each other for years and years, and we're like strangely scared of each other, right? Someone very thoughtfully brought food to the intensive care unit for all the staff, and it was like hardly touched, because we just are in this constant state of sort of paranoia and fear.
I mean, are you able to get regular testing to even know who is infected, or are you also? I mean, obviously, there's some testing going on, but are you also in the category of only if you're sick?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, you know, since we spoke last, when I said testing was a huge problem, I think testing is ramping up, but it is not ramped up. I think we are all working hard to try to get that going. We're all advocating for it. People are pushing, but all of the centers are just overwhelmed, I think. And we're really not at the point yet where I think we need to be, where we're testing all of the healthcare workers, because, you know, how many people do we see? And if one of us gets knocked out, we could take out so many of our colleagues too. So that's certainly scary.
And for your peace of mind, with just the unbelievably exhausting hours you're working. I mean, I know you've said, you know, when we were talking, you were talking about the situation in the ER and that the entire ICU has been converted to only hold coronavirus patients at this point. So I know you see stories in New York, right? They're describing the situation as apocalyptic.
Oh,
it's the entire ICU. It's also now the entire hospital. We were just talking to a doctor earlier in the show. Where are you right now in terms of coronavirus and your ICU and your hospital?
Yeah, no, sure. I think, my heart is with New York. I think all of us are. We realize that it's right now that's the hot spot. And I think what scares me most is that that is going to be a lot of places. And it's terrifying because it's not just the strain on the PPE, the equipment like ventilators. It's the strain on the staff. It's the strain on the infrastructure. And that we see that coming. Thank God we're not there yet. I think a lot of the country is watching it and wondering, will that happen to us? I think we feel the strain growing dramatically since we spoke last week. It's been already so many changes, and you feel it everywhere you go in the hospital. Our whole ICU is now focused on the care of coronavirus patients, but that doesn't mean that our ICU doctors and nurses are only looking at that. We still have a lot of other critically ill patients, and we're taking care of them wherever they are.
And right now, how are you getting through this, putting in these never-ending days, knowing that you could get sick, knowing that many of your colleagues have gotten sick, a father of young children? How are you getting through it?
Yeah. You know, I think it's bizarre because one of the things that's different, I think, about our ICU and intensive care in general is that intensive care is the long haul, right? It's not the same as the emergency room and other places. We get a patient who's sick with this virus, and if they're really, really sick, it could be days to weeks. And that is, of course, a huge drain on our staff. In a good way, because we want to get people better through critical illness, but it weighs on the staff, it weighs on everyone, because I think this is something that's missed. There's no families here. There's no families, and the families really bring an intensive care unit to life, and I think they play a huge role in patients getting better.
People are alone. They're sick or dying alone.
That's exactly what's happening. I think we try to find ways to get family as much as we can, but the combination of not enough protective equipment and also just the real fear that this could be transmitted is leaving us with critically ill patients who are left with strangers, which is us. And we do that. We do that. And that's a really meaningful part of our job. But I think we feel that the rooms are empty, too.
Well, Dr. Swamy, thank you very much. I'm glad to speak to you again. We hope you stay well. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you, Erin. I hope everyone out there is staying strong. This is a hard time for everyone, but I just want everyone out there to know that by staying home, you really are saving lives because the strain that's building is immense, and we can only handle it if people stay home. Thank you.
And next, a 38-year-old father with two little children. He is now really quarantined in just a room. He has coronavirus. He is my guest. And out front now, Craig Hollander. He is a 38-year-old father of two. He has the coronavirus. And Craig, I appreciate your taking the time. You want everyone to know you're in your home right now. You are completely isolated from your family. Tell us, how you're doing now and your symptoms. They were not typical of coronavirus, were they?
No, not from what I've read, although they may be more typical than I think than what we're hearing. Basically, it started with a fever and chills. And maybe a slight cough. My stomach was fine for the first couple of days. I thought it was a run-of-the-mill virus. I went to go get checked out. I didn't get better after a few days. I'd say about the fourth day, my stomach started turning for the worse. And I actually took that as a good sign that it wasn't COVID-19 because from what I had read, which was a lot, it was pretty much only associated with pulmonary symptoms and, people coughing and having a sore throat. And I didn't have any of those symptoms. So I thought that when my stomach went bad, it was actually a good sign. But to make a long story short, I ended up getting tested several days later and finding out that I was positive. And, I still have these GI symptoms. And at no point was my breathing impacted. I have a cough. But other than that, it's not the symptoms that most people have come to associate with COVID-19.
I think that's important for people to know, to your point, because people wouldn't necessarily expect that. But, I mentioned that you're in your room alone. It isn't that you're going to go out and see your family after this, even though you're recovering now. You have two daughters, 3 and 6. One of them has a pre-existing condition. So how worried are you that she could get sick from you? I mean, you've really isolated yourself.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, I was freaked out because, again, what I thought might have been just the flu or some other virus or a stomach bug, I didn't think that I was, risking her welfare or let alone her life by being around her. It was only after 9 or 10 days when I got a positive test result that looking back, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky that so far she's asymptomatic. Because, a lot of people out there, I'm sure, have stomach bugs or what they think are stomach bugs. And that's how COVID is actually presenting itself with them. And so they have to be really careful.
And your daughters, I know, so then now you're completely separated from them, not able to see them, not able to hug them, or they've been slipping drawings like, we'll show everyone one under the door. I mean, how hard has it been to be away from them? And to note, you've been given no timeline of when you can reengage. Yeah, I see you holding it up.
Yeah, I get these notes passed under the door, these little cards from them, and it really has been cheering me up. But we've received absolutely no guidelines about when we should expect to, be in the clear. And it's very chilling and scary because I don't want to accidentally, even though I feel fine, I've been fever-free for about 3 days now, I still have gastrointestinal issues. I still have a slight cough. I don't know. I'm not an immunologist. I don't know, or a virologist. I don't know if my cough, even though it's getting better, if that still carries the virus. I don't know anything like that. So, and no one's, other than the health department calling me to do some contact tracing, no one's called me to actually, you know, to give me guidance. Yeah.
Well, we are rooting for you and rooting for you to see those little girls. And I hope that's a lesson for the health departments to learn here. Those communications are crucial because you're going to have all these people coming out of quarantine. Thank you, Craig. We wish you the best. Thanks to all of you for joining us. CNN's Global Town Hall, Coronavirus Facts and Fears, begins now.